Good morning and welcome to Sports Interview with Ann McGorry on this Saturday morning. So glad you can join me where I am every Saturday morning right here on WLIW 88.3 FM Southampton, serving Eastern Long Island and Southern Connecticut, 96.9 in Western Suffolk, and streaming at wliw.org/radio and on your favorite streaming platforms. And each show is also archived on my website at annligori.com, that's annligori.com, and distributed on my podcast via Audioboom and iTunes. Well, I have been at the PGA Championships all week and Southern Hills Country Club in Tulsa, Oklahoma, where in 2007 I saw Tiger Woods win his 13th major title. And Tiger is here. Yes, he is. After he played in the Masters miraculously a year after that near-fatal car accident that he suffered back in February 2021, he made the cut at the Masters in April and wasn't pleased with how he finished. But he has had a little bit over a month to recuperate and get stronger for these championships, and he feels good. He said, I mean, this course is hilly, but not quite has as much elevation as Augusta National, but it's still pretty hilly, and it's going to be hot. Not as hot as it was in 2007 when temperatures were over 100 degrees during that week. But still, it's hot and humid. Well, the weather's actually going to fluctuate. It's going to get cooler toward the weekend. So interesting, early in the week, it's been very hot and humid. But Tiger is here. But Phil Mickelson is not. The defending champion, Phil Mickelson, and his absence here have really dominated the headlines early in the week, particularly after he withdrew from the championship last Friday. The Phil saga, as I'll call it, continues as he's been out of the public eye for months after he criticized the PGA Tour and backed LIV Golf, the Saudi-funded golf league. And you'll hear more about that in my interview this morning with reporter and author Alan Shipnuck, who wrote the book called Phil, The Rip-Roaring and Unauthorized Biography of Golf's Most Colorful Superstar. The book is just out, and I had a chance to sit down with Alan, who actually was the reporter that Phil Mickelson called last November and unleashed his comments criticizing the PGA Tour and his ties to the Saudi-funded golf league. And Alan wrote down the quotes and released those quotes this past February, ahead of the book publication. And Phil has basically been in exile ever since. So I talked to Alan extensively about his decision to release those quotes and about all the different personalities and complexities of Phil Mickelson, the good, the bad, and the ugly. So as I mentioned, Tiger Woods is playing this week, and when he spoke to the media on Tuesday, he was asked about Phil's absence and if he has communicated with Phil, and he said he has not spoken to Phil. A lot of it, he said, had to do with personal issues. He said it was our viewpoints of how the tour should be run that are different and what players are playing for and how we are playing for it. He says, I have a completely different stance on it. So no, he has not reached out to Phil. He says, I know the comments he made about the tour and the way that it should be run. It could be run. It could be run differently and all the different financials that could have happened. He said, I just have a very different opinion on that. So he has not reached out to him. You will hear Tiger Woods' press conference from earlier in the week at the PGA Championships, and I think you'll learn more insight into how Tiger's doing and how his health is physically since the Masters and what his rehab has been like, and also more of his comments about Phil Mickelson, who really, they've been rivals for like the past decade. It's just been a very up and down relationship. Tiger, Rory McIlroy, and Jordan Spieth are playing together in the first two rounds, which is an incredible threesome. Spieth is coming into this PGA Championship as hot as can be after winning the RBC Heritage and coming in second at the Byron Nelson, shooting a 64 in the third round there. So he is also going after a career Grand Slam. He has won all the other majors but the PGA Championship, and this is his sixth attempt to complete a career Grand Slam. And honestly, I am rooting for him. He is an incredible golfer and an extraordinarily fine human being. So I am always rooting for Jordan Spieth. Scottie Scheffler, who won the Masters in April, his fourth win in his past eight starts, is playing with reigning U.S. Open champ John Rahm and Colin Morikawa, the reigning British Open champion, in the first two rounds. Scheffler, the top-ranked player in the world, is trying to become the first golfer since Jack Nicklaus to win the Masters and the PGA Championship in the same year. And you have to admire Scheffler's mentality. He says he does not really get too high or too low. Living in the moment, he says, is usually what works best for me, staying in my own lane and doing my own thing. I think that's a great mentality to win golf majors. Bryson DeChambeau withdrew from the championship on Wednesday due to hand surgery that he had in April. He was hoping to play. He was actually at Southern Hills practicing earlier in the week to see how his hand was coming along, how it was progressing. But he decided it was not a good idea to get out and compete, which personally I think is a good idea. He doesn't want to have a setback with that hand. I mean, he only had the surgery back in April. So I know he's so passionate and he just wants to get out there and play. And I admire that in him. But, you know, he really has to listen to his doctors and take the necessary time to let it heal. Southern Hills Country Club in Tulsa, Oklahoma was renovated by Gil Hans and Jim Wagner in 2019 to restore it to Perry Maxwell's grandeur, the original designer. It was an $11 million renovation. They eliminated a number of trees to open up the property. They removed rough around the greens and all over the course, really. They removed a lot of rough. And there are a lot of greenside bunkers. So, and of course, the Oklahoma winds should play a factor. Enjoy this show from the PGA Championship.
Were you able to sort of keep ramping up the training, or was there a post-Masters lull?
Yeah, there was a huge lull Monday. That was it. That was it. Monday, it was not fun. It hurt. A lot of ice baths and just trying to get the swelling out of there. And then we went back at it leg day on Tuesday, and we kept going from there and said, let's go. You know, we figured the first mountain you climbed was Everest. I mean, that's the steepest golf course you're going to play. And that was the first one you climbed. And so it's going to get flatter and better. But still, I still have tough days. And things aren't going to be as easy as people might think. But I feel like I'm doing better. I'm having more days in which are better, more positive. Able to practice a little bit longer. So I'm able to do activities and things that I was hoping to do, and I'm finally able to do them.
What did you learn about your new body and maybe its limitations during that week at Augusta?
it was hurting, but I pushed through it, and it was more mind than body. I said I've won with a broken leg before, so. Keep on going out there, keep pushing. I know how to play the golf course. If I can just putt well, you never know. Unfortunately, Saturday, I think I had like 15 three putts. But it was one of those things that the thing that I was frustrated with is that it deteriorated as the week went on. I got more and more tired, more fatigued. I didn't have the endurance that I wanted. And now, I mean, I shouldn't expect it because I didn't earn it. I didn't go out there and I haven't done the work, but we're able to put in a little bit more work, and it's only going to get better as time goes on. So as the months pass, and it's going to get better.
Mike, one.
Tiger, what do you make of Phil not being here? Defending champion, great win last year that he had, and here he, you know, we all know what's going on. He's not here. What are your thoughts?
Well, Bob, I mean, it's always disappointing when the defending champion's not here. Phil has said some things that I think a lot of us who are committed to the tour and committed to the legacy of the tour have pushed back against, and he's taken some personal time, and we all understand that, but I think that some of his views on how the tour could be run, should be run, been a lot of disagreement there. But as we all know, as a professional, we miss him being out here. I mean, he's a big draw for the game of golf. He's just taking his time, and you know, we all wish him the best when he comes back. Obviously, we're going to have difference of opinions that how he sees the tour, and we'll go from there.
Are you surprised at all it has escalated to the point that it has, where, you know, he also missed the Masters, obviously, and we really don't know what's next?
Yeah, it has ramped up very quickly, and I think in, you know, we were talking about this, you know, if this would have happened 30 years ago, 20 years ago, it wouldn't have happened as fast, but social media has changed the landscape and how fast things can ramp up. Whether it's real news or fake news or whatever it is, opinions get out there instantly, and it can sway very quickly one way or the other. And what we're seeing right now in a society, it's very bipolar. There's really no middle ground. You stand one way or the other, and it's very polarizing. And the viewpoints that Phil has made, you know, with the tour and what the tour has meant to all of us, has been polarizing as well.
Thank you.
Mike, four, please.
Tiger, you told me a long time ago that you didn't think golf defined who you are as a person, but I think the resilience you've shown in the last year does say a lot about you. How do you think what you've accomplished over the last year since the accident might inspire others?
Well, every day is a challenge for all of us. All of us, we all have our own challenges in our own different way, right? And you wake up to the new challenge, the new day, and, you know, you got to fight through it. And some challenges are more difficult than others. It doesn't mean that they're harder or easier than others. They're just different. Mine were different than some others. Some other people have been through much worse than I have. You know, I have seen some pretty amazing things working with the military and what they've done and what they come back from. Guys have lost limbs and have come back and requalified for special forces, and things like that are inspiring, you know. And yeah, I'm gonna be sore. That's okay, but I can still get better.
Question on Mike six, please.
Tiger, you're gonna hit more driver here than more often than you did in 2007. There's more short grass around the greens. Do you think this is a better test than the one in 2007? Which would you prefer to play?
Now, given my body? Anything like around 6,200 is great. It's just different. You know, it's faster, it's more wide open. We saw how the seniors played it. A lot of balls were hitting and running off to the sides where, you know, that wasn't the case when we played in 07. It was catching in the rough. I think that some of the, there's more, for me, I think there's more slope in some of these greens. Obviously, there's more waves in the fairways and hitting very different clubs off of tees. But still, it's a challenge. And I've said earlier, I think Carey's going to set it up. You know, I think he's going to do a wonderful job setting it up. It's going to be fair. It's going to be hard. The rough is at a great length. It's interesting because you can get a ball that comes out hot or you didn't get a ball that comes out at all. And that's the great guessing game of playing Bermuda. And then with the surrounds being cut down to how they are, there's a lot more grain than we ever had to deal with. So, you know, there are going to be different shots. You know, guys are – I've seen guys use hybrids. I've seen guys use three woods, putts, wedges, four irons. I mean, you'll see a variety of different things. And then the forecast is going to be different every day, and there's wind supposed to be all different directions. So we're going to see different golf courses almost every day.
Mike, number five.
Tiger, you mentioned that you kind of lost endurance as the mm-hmm. round at the Masters went on. What have you learned about your body or the recovery process since that's going to be able to help you recover better after the rounds and be able to last longer into the tournament?
Well, my team did just an amazing job just to get me to the point where I could play the Masters, and I was able to have that opportunity to play. right after each round, it was like, get back to the house, and we have an ice bath ready for you, and off you go, get on the treatment table, and you know, let's keep working at it, keep things going. And it was tough, it was hard, on all of us. But I've gotten stronger since then. But still, it's still going to be sore, and you know, walking is a challenge. I can hit golf balls, but it's the challenge is walking, and it's going to be that way for foreseeable future for sure.
In the back row, 14.
Yeah, Tiger. With the foundation, have you considered an event much like the one Bill Dickey used to put on? Sure you remember him.
Oh yeah.
That would benefit kids all over the country and give people a chance to see exactly what the foundation is doing.
Well, see, we've gone away from golf-based events. We had fundraisers that are golf-based events, but our foundation is not based in golf. Our fundraising is based in golf, but our program is based in STEM. So we focus on STEM, getting kids into STEM programs, in a variety of different STEM programs. But yes, we use golf as a fundraiser, but we're not here to produce professional golfers. We're here to give underserved kids better chances in life. And I think that's more important.
Thank you.
Mm-hmm. Mike, nine, please.
Hey, yeah. Tiger, how close are you physically now to being as good as it's going to get based on your injuries?
I don't know. That's a great question. I don't know. There's going to be limitations. I mean, there's a lot of hardware in there, and there's going to be limitations to what I'm going to be able to do. But I'm going to get stronger. I don't know how much that is or how much range of motion I'll ever get back. But sure as a hell of a lot better than it was, you know, 12 months ago.
Mike, nine now, please.
Yeah, Tiger, you mentioned all the changes to the golf course. One, do you like those changes? Then two, your winning score here was 8-under in 07. Do you envision it being similar? All the guys have mentioned it's playing tougher then, so do you envision that score maybe being lower?
I think it all depends on where Carey puts the pins. When I watched the seniors play, and there was a lot of balls running off the sides, a lot of chip shots. But, you know, we're getting these young kids hitting the ball high and far, and, you know, a couple of the par fives are, 630, and guys are knocking on there in two, some of the guys. Depends on the wind, obviously. But the guys have a lot more power than what we did in 07. I mean, look at what we did on the range. We can't use the top end of the range anymore because guys are hitting it down on the bottom. So the game has changed a lot, and because the game has changed a lot, Gil's done a fantastic job of altering the golf course. And it has a lot more shot options, that's for sure. And we're going to be tested around the greens a lot. A lot of grain, a lot of creativity. But it still puts a premium on putting the ball in play and on the fairway and keeping the ball somehow below the holes in the right spots. As I said, there's still a lot of slope in some of these greens, a lot of pitch. But it is kind of nice to see 9 and 18 not cut at a different speed.
Question on three.
Tiger, how confident are you that you can contend this week? And just basically, can you win this week?
I feel like I can, yeah. Definitely. I just got to go out there and do it. I got to do my work. And starts on Thursday, and I'll be ready.
Question on 12.
Yeah, Tiger, you mentioned your putting at Augusta, particularly that Saturday, didn't go the way you wanted it to. Do you feel like with your physical limitations, you're able to practice enough with the putter to get that club back to a championship level?
What? No. As far as practicing a lot, no, I don't do that anymore. Bending over and hitting a bunch of putts like I used to, that doesn't happen. Not with my back the way it is. And I got to pick my spots, do my work, and get in and then get out. I can do different sessions. You know, I have a great complex in the backyard, but I can do like different times throughout the day and do like a 20-minute segment here, a 20-minute segment there, another 20-segment later on in the evening. I can break it up and do it that way instead of putting for 2-3 hours in a row like I used to. I just have to do it differently.
Eight.
Tiger, you said to Bob about the disagreement with a lot of what Phil had said. From your point of view, how does he resolve that disagreement, or does he have to resolve that disagreement? What do you think?
I don't know if he has to resolve it or not. You know, he has his opinion on where he sees the game of golf going. You know, I have my viewpoint on how I see the game of golf, and I've supported the tour, and my foundation has run events on the tour for a number of years, and I just think that what Jack and Arnold have done in starting the tour and breaking away from the PGA of America and creating our tour, in 68 or 69, somewhere in there, I just think that there's a legacy to that. I've been playing out here for a number of years, for over a couple of decades, and I think there's a legacy to it. And I still think that what the tour has so much to offer, so much opportunity. Yes, it is. I understand different viewpoints, but I believe in legacies. I believe in major championships. I believe in big events, comparisons to historical figures of the past. And it's, you know, there's plenty of money out here. The tour is growing. But it's just like any other sports, like tennis. You got to go out there and earn it. You got to go out there and play for it. We have the opportunity to go ahead and do it. It's just not guaranteed up front.
Over here on nine, please. Nine.
Sorry, Tiger, yeah. With your event, you have rights fees that you pay to the tour in some form or another. Do you think Phil, because he hadn't done events before some of these matches and whatnot, do you think he just didn't understand the rights fees and how they work?
I can't speak for him not knowing and understanding that. I'm sure he probably does have an understanding of that because he was the host of the term, the old Bob Hope. So since he was the host of the event, I'm sure he probably understands it. And plus he hosts the event up there in Napa Valley. So he understands that, and there is a rights fee to having events and understanding it, and we negotiate with the tour, and whether it's one-off day events like we have with matches under the lights like I used to do, you know, back in the old days, or it's regular tour events, each term is different, and obviously there's rights fees that have to be paid, and we understand that, and obviously, we go in there as events and try to negotiate that down as low as possible and try and make as much money as we can for the local events.
It is my pleasure to say hello to Alan Shipnuck, author of Phil, the Rip-Roaring and Unauthorized Biography of Golf's Most Colorful Superstar. And the book comes out on Tuesday. Welcome to Talking Golf, Alan.
Thanks for having me. I'm happy to be here.
It's good to talk with you. And you could not have written about a more fascinating personality. And I found your writing, the way you detail Phil Mickelson's life, really fascinating. There's a lot of inside information on Phil, tons of stories, and your research, the number of interviews you did, very in-depth.
Well, I appreciate that. Thank you. I mean, that was always my goal, was to write a very balanced, kind of nuanced look at a very complex character. And, you know, Phil's had a big controversial life, and there's been thrilling victories and slapstick defeats, and there's been controversy, and he's given back so much to the fans and to the game, and he's taken plenty as well. So it was a fun challenge to capture the many different multitudes within Phil Mickelson.
Absolutely. And we'll get into all those personality traits in a minute, but you know, I found the book to be fair. I mean, you included many positive stories about the time he helped Ryan Palmer, whose wife was diagnosed with breast cancer. Phil connected him to top doctors and assured him that she would be okay. And a lot of his philanthropic work that he and his wife Amy do, and how generous a tipper he is. I mean, extremely generous tipper, and how he makes many fans and spectators feel just so special with those random acts of kindness. So I thought there was a good balance in the book.
Well, that means a lot to me. It really does, because, you know, there's obviously the excerpts, and it's funny because I said to my editor, Simon Schuster, at one point, I said, why don't we put an excerpt out about, you know, Phil's philanthropy and all his virtues and all the great things he's done to touch people. He's like, nobody cares. Nobody's going to read that. It's like, unfortunately, the world we live in, to cut through the clutter and to get people to pay attention to something like a book coming out it demands like a little racier material. And so some of that got pulled out of the book and early on. And I think that's given certain fans and, you know, readers not a full picture of what this book really is. And it's to capture the totality of Phil. And, you know, I didn't enjoy singing his praises and reciting his virtues, but he's been involved in a lot of messiness, and there has been a lot of controversy, and that's all in the book too.
Well, and as you pointed out in the book, he is the master at mind games, and he majored in psychology at Arizona State. But say a professional psychologist were to dissect his personality, I would think that would even be a challenge for a professional. I mean, he's the epitome of contradictions. And I just wrote down, you know, some adjectives: multidimensional, a mix of genius, ego, defiance, smarts, compulsive behavior, impulsive behavior, sometimes compassionate, other times ruthless. One moment, sweet as can be, the next moment, devilish, with plenty of misjudgments and self-righteousness thrown in. Would you agree?
Yeah, that's an excellent summary there, Anne. Yeah. He's all of those things. I mean, we all have our contradictions, but with Phil, they just seem exaggerated because he's such a big personality. He's had such a big life. And, you know, it's really hard to define him, you know, and that's a question I've gotten so often in my, you know, I've sit on an airplane next to somebody and they find out what I do for a living. And one of the first questions invariably is, what is Phil Mickelson really like? He's always been so polarizing, you know. Very few people are neutral about Phil. Like, they have strong feelings. He inspires emotion, and that's a good thing. But it's all over, it runs the whole gamut. And so, I think you did a good job of summarizing. You could add a whole bunch more words in there. Like, he's a very larger than life character, and he's very multifaceted. And of course, that's what makes him interesting.
Absolutely. And, you know, I've been covering him probably as long as you have, you know, from the beginning of his professional career, certainly. And he's obviously never shy when it comes to stating a strong opinion, right? No matter the consequences, under this global microscope. You know, I was at Glen Eagles in Scotland at the Ryder Cup in 2014, when he basically threw the U.S. Ryder Cup captain Tom Watson under the bus for his coaching style and comparing it to, you know, Paul Azinger. And I remember Phil criticizing Hale Sutton's captaincy in 2004. And then in what I thought was the most unfortunate, idiotic move, Alan, I saw him run after his putt on the 13th green at Shinnecock during the 2018 US Open and hitting the ball while it was moving. I mean, who does that?
Right. And that's Phil too. He can be petulant and he can be selfish. And, you know, the Watson business is really fascinating. And I think it's germane to the current moment with Saudi Arabia, in that Phil sees himself as both kind of a hero and a martyr. And so while, you know, he was fueled by personal grievance because Watson benched him on that Saturday at the Ryder Cup, and it had been tense all week between the two of them. Phil also recognized something had to change. The U.S. was just getting their butt kicked every Ryder Cup. There was all these structural issues that had never been addressed. There was a lack of cohesion from one captaincy to the next, and there was not the resources they needed from the PGA of America and all these things. And he knew this was the moment to really affect change. Now, there's a lot of ways he could have handled it. He chose the most provocative, which was just to destroy Tom Watson in front of the world. But it did lead to, because of the pressure and the energy around that moment, it did force change. And the U.S. might not lose a Ryder Cup for the next decade, because a lot of the things that Phil pushed for and that were needed came out as a result. So was it incredibly awkward to be in that room, which I was, you know, yes. And did it affect Tom Watson's legacy? And did it affect Phil in some ways? Of course. And was it the right thing to do? That's debatable, but it is undeniably effective. And that, you know, I think it's kind of analogous to what's going on in Saudi Arabia. Is Phil wanted to be an agent of change. Now, there's a lot of different ways he could have done it, but he saw a lot of things that he's been frustrated with the PGA Tour for a very long time. And all of a sudden he was presented this leverage to the Saudis and he took advantage of it. And this is kind of blown up in spectacular fashion, but Phil wasn't wrong on some of these issues, and some of the things he was pushing for, the PGA Tour has done. And so he's not afraid to put himself out there, and he's not afraid to stir the pot. And I've always liked and respected that about Phil, but it's a complex part of his legacy for sure.
It really is. And I want to get into that more. So you asked Phil several times to give you an interview, but he refused, right?
Yeah. Which I went to him face to face three times and asked him to sit for interviews for this book. And he thought about it and ultimately decided he didn't want to do it. And that was okay. That's his prerogative. I've had a lot of access to Phil and the people around him across the last three decades. So I did explain to him, I said, I think it's in your best interest to tell your side of every story and to put your spin on things, but he chose not to do that.
And so how did you react when Phil texted you last November and said he was going to call you?
I mean, I was delighted because of course I wanted to talk to him for the book, you know, through his lawyer. The lawyer had called and tried to hire me to be a consultant as Phil was gearing up to take on the tour over the media rights issues, which was really weird. I mean, I'm in the middle of writing this biography about the guy. I can't take his money. I think that's the most obvious conflict of interest, and that they'd even make that offer was bizarre. But, you know, I knew the media rights was on Phil's was what he wanted to talk about. And it was a little underwhelming. I thought it was gonna be a boring phone call that got into, you know, these arcane PGA Tour issues about NFTs and how you can use their name, image, likeness. But obviously I'm not going to say no, I wanted to talk to Phil. And, but obviously the conversation became a lot more provocative and he went deep on the Saudi Arabia stuff. And I was amazed by his candor and his bluntness. But, you know, Phil Mickelson never opens his mouth without an agenda. And he's a very smooth operator who spent his whole career charming and cajoling and bullying reporters. And he's a master of the media. And it's part of why he's gotten such great press through the years, despite all the controversies. So, you know, he had an agenda when he called me, and I didn't quite know that going in, but I certainly knew by the time that the phone call was over.
Now, were you taping this conversation?
I wasn't taping it. I was just taking notes on my computer, like as a stenographer, which is how I do most of my interviews. And, you know, in hindsight, of course, I wish I had, because it took such a turn, but I really wasn't expecting the fireworks that came out of it.
I was going to say, I mean, you know, just to review, he called you in November. He got in a soapbox criticizing the PGA Tour, talking about the atrocities taking place in Saudi Arabia. And despite that, he was working with various players and lawyers to write this Saudi League's operating agreement, and then saying his involvement was an effort to use it as leverage to get more for the players on the PGA Tour. Does that pretty much sum it up? I mean, he was his language was pretty strong, and okay, he really criticized the commissioner of the PGA Tour.
Yeah, no, that's a good summary. I mean, he had some very provocative things to say. And what's interesting about the whole affair is that Saudi Arabia has successfully bought its way into professional golf. You know, they host an event every year that's sanctioned by the European Tour. They are now in partnership with the Asian Tour. I mean, the Saudis have bought their way into the game for better and for worse. And everyone takes their money, including Phil. You know, he's one of the bunch of top players that go over there every late January, early February to play in the Saudi International. And it's become accepted. And that's the insidious thing about sports washing, is that it works. And so I was honestly surprised at the amount of blowback on Phil, because it seemed obvious to me what he was doing, which was he was working both sides of the street and trying to pit the Saudis against the PGA Tour and using that leverage against each side. But the reason I think it touched such a nerve was he strayed off script, because usually when these guys go over there and take the money, they say, "Oh, we're just trying to grow the game. And I'm a athlete, not a politician." I mean, everybody rolls their eyes, but you can only express your moral outrage so often. And so they kind of get a pass, but Phil was so blunt, and, you know, he said the quiet parts out loud, and that was what was provocative. Along with the fact, and, you know, he was so callous in dismissing the Saudi atrocities. But I think ultimately it was the sneakiness that is what really got him in trouble, was that, you know, as he admitted to me that, he'd had a role in the creation of the actual operating agreement of the Saudi Golf League. And, you know, that's directly working against the interests of the PGA Tour, which has been an amazing platform for him to earn, you know, worldwide acclaim and obviously quite a great living. And so it was the combination of the callousness and the sneakiness that is what set him apart from everybody else who's taken the Saudi money. And all that said, I was still surprised that it blew up the way it did, because the Saudis are part of golf now, but Phil just took it to a whole different level.
Well, you know Phil well enough. Did he seem sober when he called you?
That's funny. I mean, he's not that kind of drinker. Phil loves a good red wine at dinner, but this was a Sunday afternoon during football season. So, I guess it's worth thinking about. He sounded fine. I mean, he was razor sharp and he was fired up and he was a little bit emotional. And, I have no reason to believe that, but you know, I think what happens, and I've been in this business a long time, and if I have any skill as an interviewer, a lot of it is silence. I just let people talk. And, you know, of course I'm going to ask questions and I might push them in one direction or another, but, and people sometimes they get carried away and by the sound of their own voice, and they get fired up and they go further than they plan to, or they expected to. And maybe that's what happened here. You know, it's quite possible when Phil called me, he wasn't going to tell me some of these things, but in the flow of the conversation, he couldn't help himself. And it's not my role to provide guardrails. You know, he's not a wide-eyed rookie. I mean, he's a very cagey manipulator of the media. So if he wants to tell me something, I'm going to listen to it. And I can't speak exactly what Phil's motivations were. I mean, I'm still somewhat baffled. You know, if he wanted to share his innermost feelings about Saudi Arabia, he could have called any reporter. Why did he call the one guy writing his biography? You know, he used the word reckless in that public statement. And I think that was part of the fun for Phil. Like, it was the thrill of it. Like, I'm telling this guy some very provocative stuff and it's a little dangerous. And I think he liked that because that's who he is. So I'm still amazed that he called me and told me all that stuff. And sometimes I wish he never hadn't, because when he called me, the book was due a week later. It was done basically. And there was already a lot of juicy stuff in there. It was already a book that I loved and was proud of. And you know, if he had never called me, I wouldn't have known that stuff. It wouldn't be in the book. It wouldn't be public. And there'd be a whole different feeling around this release and certainly in Phil's life. But, you know, once he told me all that, I felt like I have a fiduciary duty here. Like it would have been journalistic malpractice not to inform the readers and other stakeholders in the game of what was really happening.
So you never considered not distributing his quotes, printing his quotes based on perhaps it would destroy his whole legacy?
I mean, that I don't have that power. You know, Phil has he's the one who was negotiating with the Saudis. He's the one who called me and told me about it. So at that point, you know, I have my fidelity is to the reader, it's to the truth. And I'm not here to do Phil's bidding or the Saudis or the PGA Tours or anybody else's. Like, you know, my allegiance is to the real story. And it was one of the biggest questions in golf. You know, what does Phil want? And nobody knew except for me. And to not put that out into the world would have been a very curious choice for a reporter and for a biographer.
I mean, obviously the words led to sponsor stumping him, led to Phil going dark. We still don't know what Phil's going to do and when he's going to turn up next. But I mean, though, it was huge consequences. So you never thought of not releasing the damaging quotes?
No, I mean, the answer is no. I mean, it's like when I set out to write this book, it was to present to the world what Phil is really like. And people have said, oh, is this like, are you out to get him? Is this some takedown? Not at all. I just want people to know who Phil is and to present all sides of his personality. And this is an important piece of it. So no, I never for a second considered that, because it's if you want to understand Phil Mickelson, this Saudi stuff is very revealing.
It really is. I mean, his phone call to you, as shocked as you are, do you perhaps think it was a cry for help? I mean, maybe he is really involved in, I mean, you mentioned a lot of the gambling, a lot of things that went on in the book, a lot of detail, insider information, right? That you reveal in the book.
Yeah.
Do you think it was a cry for help?
Well, I think his public statement that followed that, where he talked about, I've let a lot of people down, I'm going to take time away to become a better man, that was much bigger than Saudi Arabia. That felt like a cry for help. I think his motivation in calling me was he wanted to go on record with what was really happening, and he wanted to wink at golf fans. So if he takes the Saudi money and everyone's outraged, he's already on record like saying, hey, I know they're bad guys. This is strictly business. And if that thing blew up and he remained with the PGA Tour, it would have looked like a political defeat for him. But he would have told me all the concessions he earned, all his jousting with Jay Monahan, the PGA Tour commissioner. And so he was kind of working both sides of the street. And it's, you know, it's been said many times about Phil is he has this need to be the smartest guy in the room. It's like cliche that follows him around. But ultimately, I think he just couldn't help himself. He wanted me to know how he had gamed the system, and he was leveraging both sides against each other, and he was getting everything he'd always wanted. And even though he'd already said no to me three times, he couldn't resist calling me and telling me how smart he is. And so there was a lot going on in that phone call on a deep psychological level. I don't think it was quite a cry for help, but it was definitely so revealing of who he is and the way he's lived his life. And to use his own word, it was reckless, but I think that was part of the thrill of it. And, you know, now the public statement that followed that hints at some deeper things, and, you know, we'll see what comes out here as he returns to public life.
We're talking to Alan Shipnuck, the author of the rip roaring and unauthorized biography of golf's most colorful superstar. The book comes out Tuesday. And in his February 22nd statement, Alan, Phil wrote, "There is a problem of off the record comments being shared out of context and without my consent." How did you react to that?
Well, I was outraged because none of that's true. I mean, out of context, we were talking about Saudi Arabia and the PGA Tour. Without my consent, he called me. And off the record is a two-way street. It's an agreement between an interviewer and a subject. And Phil never asked to go off the record. And if he had, I would have pushed back really hard because this is my one chance to talk to him. You know, I've made three requests to interview him for this book. He finally reaches out to me. Every single thing he says is going directly in the book unless we expressly agree otherwise. And we never did. I never consented to it. He never asked for it. Like, this interview was on the record the whole way. And for him to say otherwise after the fact was really disappointing. And again, I think it reveals something about him. You know, instead of just saying, yeah, I said what I said, this is what I feel, you know, he tried to talk his way out of it yet again. But on a personal level, it was quite disappointing that he would do that. There's certainly a road back for Phil. I mean, Tiger Woods put his family and his fans and the game through much worse with some of it, with his scandals. And he's more beloved than he's ever been. And I think sports fans are very forgiving. They love a comeback. They love a redemption story. Phil's never been down and out like this before. And if he can come back a little more humble and a little more human, I think he'll be greeted with open arms and people want to cheer for him again. So the one X factor in that is if he does go all in with the Saudis and he does take their money after the things he said, and we know his true feelings, he's going to lose some fans that way. And it's going to be hard for them to really forgive him. But that we don't know what's going to happen. And even that the whole future of that circuit is up in the air. I mean, it seems destined to head to the courts after the, you know, the PGA Tour denied the releases for their players to play in that first event in June. So Phil's at a crossroads here professionally and personally, and where he goes from here, I'm as fascinated as everybody else to see.
It just adds to the mystique, to his compelling personality. I mean, the PGA Tour, as you mentioned, has denied members permission to compete in that Saudi Arabia-backed LIV Golf Invitational that takes place in London next month. So having spent so much time talking and thinking about Phil, do you think he'll play in it?
It's so hard to know because, you know, again, there's a lot at work here. First of all, Phil wants to be, he wants to be this agent of change. So he's motivated by philosophical things, but clearly the money is very alluring. And, you know, I have a lot of reporting in the book about Phil's gambling, and it's substantial, and it makes you wonder, does he need the money? Is it a necessity? You would never have thought that given the, you know, second all time on the tour money list and all the money he's made, you know, in endorsements, but his gambling losses have been substantial enough that you have to at least ask the question, like, does he really need this money? Because why is he chasing it so hard? On the other hand, you know, Phil does want to be beloved by the public, and I don't think Saudi Arabia is the way to do that. So there's some competing interests here. But as much as anything, he wants to be right. He wants to be validated in this quest. And so there's these warring impulses within Phil. That's always been part of who he is. He has these incredible contradictions, as most humans do, but his are exaggerated. And so I think this is a real tough decision for him. And I don't know what he's going to do. And I'm not even sure Phil knows at this moment, but it's going to have to return to public life soon. And he's going to have to make these choices.
You have to wonder if it is solely about money. I mean, according to sources, and you wrote about this in the book, he had gambling losses totaling more than $40 million in a four-year period between 2010 and 2014. And it could be more than that, correct? I mean, that's from, you know, some of the documents that you were able to locate.
Yeah, I mean, we don't know what we don't know. I mean, so yeah, and that's just a snapshot, you know, of a moment in time. And that was, you know, as part of the Billy Walters insider trading case, you know, Phil is subject to this you know, forensic audit of his finances. That's where that number comes from. So it's just hard to say exactly what his financial state is, but clearly he's sustained some heavy losses gambling. And does that just end? I mean, we know that personality that Phil has. It's quite, he always wants more. And so we don't have all the answers, but we have some hints, and it does suggest that he might need this Saudi money more than we thought.
How do you think Phil Mickelson will react to this unauthorized biography once he and his lawyers read it?
I sent it to him a couple of weeks ago through one of his lawyers, and you know, I said, I tucked in a little handwritten note and said, I hope you can read this with an open mind and see that it was written with a lot of affection, because I've always enjoyed Phil. It's been a blast to cover him for his whole career. And the people who have read it, almost all of them have said some variation of, oh, it was very fair and balanced. And that was my goal. And, you know, as we were talking about before, I spent a lot of pages on Phil's virtues, and but for sure there's some messiness there. And so it's hard, I think, for people to read about themselves objectively. So he's probably not going to love the book, but hopefully he'll at least see that it's balanced. And that's really all I can do. You know, I didn't write it for Phil. It's not a project we did together. You know, this is his story that in a very unvarnished look at it. And so I don't know. I mean, at the same time, we'll see. I'll be curious what his reaction is, you know, when he comes back. And is he going to try and attack the book or attack me, which, you know, that's one route to go. But I don't think that would be good public relations either. It just brings more attention to the book. But that's Phil's call. And, you know, all I can say is the truth is my shield. And everything that's in the book was, you know, heavily vetted and sourced. And, you know, it's just the real story.
Well, as you mentioned, Tiger did transform his image. So it will be interesting to see. It's all in Phil's court if he can rebound from all this ugliness that has taken place, not only these last few months, but, you know, throughout his whole career. I mean, there's been some serious stuff going on, and he's been lucky, especially with the indictment of the Billy Walters character. I mean, Phil was very lucky in that entire scenario, don't you think?
Yeah, without a doubt. I mean, his timing was impeccable. It's all in the book. It's a little complex to go through here, but there was two court cases at the federal level that kind of bracketed that case and created this window of opportunity where Phil couldn't be charged. But if his case had come due before or after those rulings, he would have been in much more legal jeopardy potentially. So it's just a fascinating episode among many, and whether it's, you know, Phil just has a habit. Even last, you know, a month after he wins a PGA, he goes to Detroit, and you know they wrote the story about this old bookie that he was using, who was based in Detroit, and they had some fresh reporting on that. And Phil turned it into, you know, he was attacking the reporter, attacking the newspaper, and to this feel good tournament right after the PGA. And he turned, this was a small story that was behind a paywall that very few people saw, and Phil made it a global story. They put on the other side of the paywall so everybody could read it and retweet it. And he just has a habit of pouring gasoline on the fire. And so it's a singular life. I mean, the stuff he steps in is remarkable. And but yet somehow he just keeps going. He just keeps sailing on. So if nothing else, Phil's a survivor, and I think he'll survive all of this as well. But it's a very fraught moment for him. There's no question.
And the next couple of weeks are going to be very interesting. Alan Shipnick, author of Phil, the Rip Roaring and Unauthorized Biography of Golf's Most Colorful Superstar. Thank you so much. I could go on and on, but we'll save it for another show.
Well, thanks for having me, Ann. This was a great conversation. I appreciate your time.
Thanks so much. My thanks to Alan Shipnick, the author of the Unauthorized Biography on Phil Mickelson that recently came out. My thanks to Mike Goodsell in production and to Delaney Hefner in the studio. Stay well, stay safe, and I'll talk to you next Saturday morning right here on Sports Interview with Ann Liguori.